Welcome to the MuloCG podcast, the podcast which explores multilingualism and imagined geographies as sources of creativity for world literature. Led by researchers at SOAS and funded by the European Research Council, this project focuses on three significant geographies: North India, the Maghreb, and the Horn of Africa. This is the second podcast from the Postcolonial Print Cultures Conference held at SOAS on the 11th and 12th of January 2019. Letitia Zucchini is a research associate at CRNS Paris. Her talk, How Do We Stop Being Somebody Else's Image? The Struggle for Cultural Freedom and Poetics and Politics in Cold War Bombay, discussed the politics of literary translation and publication.
So this paper presents itself like a follow-up of my presentation last year, in which I discussed how Indian literatures were changed by the traveling literatures, the new cultural conversations made possible by the Cold War, when both blocs were engaged in pressing the fight, that's Barnesall and Turner's fortunate expression, and devising an arsenal of cultural weapons, such as book programs, translations, to counter, depending on which side you were on, capitalist or communist challenge. So the idea was to re-examine modernism and its privileged medium, the little magazine, in the light of the Cold War, through a dimension that I had overlooked in my previous work, namely the politics and economics of literary circulation, at a time when the transnational literary traffics were also, as we all know, conditioned by a form of embattlement, with publishing machineries harnessed by powerful ideologies which ensured the translation, canonization of certain writers and certain texts and also certain ideas. So a lot of the books that did get to circulate at the time were sponsored by private foundations, governmental organizations, or state-funded programs, acting as multipliers of the right kind of media. That's Joel Whitney's expression. And amongst these multipliers, I examined in particular the role of two institutions, the ICCF, which Francesca has talked about. So it's the Indian branch started in 1951 in Bombay of the Anti-Communist Congress for Cultural Freedom, indirectly funded by the CIA, and the Overseas Service of the United States Information Agency, or USIS, whose mandate covered everything from the Voice of America radio program to the dissemination of print materials to the running of USIS libraries. So since the communist-oriented bloc is far more documented in the Indian subcontinent, and since the trope of freedom with which modernism is often equated was turned into a weapon by becoming the main catchword enlisted by the US to rally against communism and also to counter its own rhetorical trope of peace, my focus has been on the liberal, American-influenced anti-communist lineage. Denis de Rougemont, at the inaugural ICCF conference in Bombay, declared, "Our way of defending our liberties will be to make ourselves vigilant watchmen and guardians of the true meaning of words." And he was specifically addressing the notion of freedom. So the struggle over the political, cultural, and aesthetic implication of freedom, over the ownership of the notion, which is a defining feature of the cultural Cold War, was also a struggle over the meanings of modernism and a struggle over form. That's what I would like to concentrate on today, on the struggle for cultural freedom or independence, which certain spaces, like the journal Quest, although it was sponsored by the ICCF, and certain writers represented in the 50s and 60s, and focus on two figures, Nissim Ezekiel, who was also the first editor of Quest for 2 years, who, although he's recognized as a canonical figure of Indian poetry in English, is paradoxically often dismissed and his vast critical work neglected, and somebody called J.S. Saxena, a writer and lecturer at Allahabad University, whom Arvind Krishnamurthy, the poet and critic, regarded as one of his heroes, but who died totally forgotten in the 70s. So refusing to be straitjacketed by ideology, by the state, by foreign patrons, or by models imported from elsewhere, models that were inseparably political and literary, including, of course, models of modernity and modernism, since, as I've just suggested, modernism was also a rhetorical device institutionalized during the Cold War. So refusing to be straitjacketed, Saxena and Ezekiel, along with later writers such as Merotra or Josawala, struggled to clear alternative critical voices and spaces for themselves, to craft their own signature of modernism, and to define in their own terms the many meanings and forms of freedom. I would argue that their struggle was also, to echo the title of the conference, to free form, free modernism, and even free the notion of freedom itself, as it were, from ideology that was so prevalent at the time. So some of the words included in the title of my presentation today, The Struggle for Cultural Freedom, of course, echo Ngugi Wa Thiong'o's book, Moving the Centers of the Struggle for Cultural Freedoms, when he talks of the 60s as a period when countries in Asia and Africa were asserting their right to define themselves from their own centers. And there's, of course, the decolonial, anti-colonial dimension in that quest for cultural and political independence, in the need to shake free from Western models and ideologies. But what I would like to stress here is that both for Saxena and Ezekiel, the idea of cultural freedom is inseparable from the idea of free, independent criticism, which must once again be understood both as political criticism, the right to criticize the state, the institutions, the government, the right to defy censorship, and cultural criticism. Literary and artistic criticism, they argue, is direly lacking in India at the time. So Saxena will talk about a culture of shortages, a diagnosis, that was later taken up by so many of the writers I've been interested in. Merotra, for example, who in a little magazine in 1972 writes, as Saxena has remarked, ours is a literature in a culture of shortages. The miracle is still right. And Ezekiel's whole quest has been to carve a critical and literary space, mindful of what he calls many voices, mindful of differences and dissent. So all these notions, independence, pluralism, non-conformism, being qualities he associated with the liberal outlook, with liberalism. So both writers, Ezekiel and Saxena, wrestled with this idea of freedom. In one of his editorials for Quest in the 50s, Ezekiel writes, that was meant to be on the PowerPoint, which would have been easier, but what exactly do we mean when we call a society free? The question raised at the outset cannot be answered merely by asserting that the communist society is the perfect antithesis of the free society. A non-communist society, such as the Indian, does not qualify for the label free. In fact, there is a constant need to explore the conditions in which it exists. We must probe, doubt, question, question, question. As soon as freedom is taken for granted, it is already diminished. And in a later text, writing about independence, he writes, independence brought me a sense of happiness tempered with the questions that we didn't seem to be asking ourselves, such as how we should use it and what part of independence we should internalize. I spent August 1947 on my own trying out that feeling. Again and again, that question to be free, what did it mean? So what did it mean in a culture of shortages? What did it mean without, they felt, adequate, vigorous spaces, mediums, associations, or even institutions where ideas, books, literature, culture could be debated, judgments and skills honed or tested? What did it mean in a state of economic dependence? And this, I think, is really crucial. In an interview in 1973, Mohan Rakesh contends that if a lot of the intellectuals in the 50s became pawns in the game played by the United States and the USSR, it's largely due to economic dependence. And Ezekiel's essays revolve around this question of the role, the relevance of a culture and a literature in a country where the scale of poverty and destitution is so huge. Significantly, Merotra's first line of the first letter he sent in 1966 to the American Small Press founder Howard McCord mentions USIS as the place to visit if you are a young Indian writer with an editorial project in mind and no cash. USIS is mentioned several times in these letters. In 1968, for instance, when Merotra, attacking the establishment's hostility towards him, refers to the scandal that erupted in 1966 when the New York Times revealed CIA's role in funding the CCF. And he writes, "Once you ask me from where Ezekiel manages the money, should I tell you, the CIA, and nearly all the mags here do the same. No wonder." But I would argue that in spite of the American funding and hidden agenda of many of these journals, to some extent, and that goes with what you were saying, Francesca, it's in these spaces intended for other means that many writers cleared a space for themselves. Of course, a journal like Quest is inflected by the credo of the CCF, which in the first page of the first issue in 1955 is described as an association of free men bound together by their devotion to the cause of freedom. And almost all the essays published by non-Indians in the journal from the mid-50s to the early 60s belong to the intellectual constellation of the Congress. So you have Arthur Koestler, Stephen Spender, Raymond Aron, and many others. Yet, despite Quest's anti-communist lineage, Marguerite Sabin, I think, is completely right to claim that what attracted writers to this journal was a hope that they could use rather than be used by their own sponsors. Ezekiel talks of the disbelief and disdain of so many editors towards Indian poetry in English, for example, when he went from publisher to publisher in the 50s, or looked in vain for review space. At least journals like Quest or Imprint or others did provide him with that space. And many of the major poets and writers of the times were published in these journals. In Quest, in the 50s and 60s, for example, you find, and Francesca has mentioned them as well, of course, Kolatkar, Dilip Chitre, but also Jibananda Das, Aga Shahid Ali, Ramanujad, Krishna Baldeved, Agye, Anantamurti, and so many others. Remember Ezekiel's editorial. What exactly do we mean when we call a society free? We must probe, doubt, question, question, question. The aim of Quest, at least in Ezekiel's mind, was precisely to ask such questions over the meanings and the forms of freedom, to foster an independent critical culture by cultivating debate, and create the conditions in which freedom to argue, to disagree, to criticize can thrive in India, and cultural independence realize political independence. So that, and I love Ezekiel's expression here, so that the coexistence of ideologies is displaced by a ferment of ideas. That's in one of his editorials in 1957. Likewise, despite CCF patronage, the 1951 ICCF Bombay Conference bears witness to the fact that many Indian writers refused to submit to outside pressure or expected alignments. Indian participants point to the fallacy of having to choose between the so-called shepherds and the lambs, that's a metaphor used by Denis de Rougemont in his inaugural speech, and refusing to be terrified. That's Buddhadev Bose talking, so I quote him, "Refusing to be terrified, we in India can try to build our lives in our own quiet way instead of modeling ourselves on the great world powers who are now the hope and the terror of other nations." So all these questions resonate with an article entitled "The Coffee Brown Boy Looks at the Black Boy," that J.S. Saxena published in Quest in 1970, which gives the struggle for freedom or independence an enraged tone. In the article, Saxena rejects the brown boy's compulsion to catch up with the West. I quote him, Two centuries ago, as Frantz Fanon puts it, a former colony of Europe and a rather backward Euro-Asian country decided to catch up with what was known as the West. They succeeded so well that the US and its mirror image, the Soviet Union, have become the most frightening monsters man has ever known. Unquote. The only alternative, he says, resides in the pure logic of refusal, which forms like blues or jazz represent, and whose practitioners, he argues, represent a permanent reserve of misfits condemned to minority. That does not mean, however, for Indians to mimic the forms and mediums this minority, the black minority in the US, generated to protest and survive. And Saxena writes, when the Coffee Brown boys take up jazz, they are neither protesting nor revolting, but only trying to be American. And that's really a leitmotif of the text and a concern shared by many of these writers. How to resist mimetism, how to stop writing, thinking like, how to stop being pawns in other people's games or images framed by others. And I quote Saxena again. The zest with which the status symbols of Europe and America are imbibed cannot cover up the nullity of the Coffee Brown boys' existence. How do we stop being somebody else's image? I do not want to be an image, even the most luminous image in somebody else's mind. I do not want to waste my life catching up with somebody else's dream of me. Freedom does not lie in searching for meanings in the debris of your own life, which somebody else has hidden for you to find. It consists in making meanings for yourself, unquote. So both writers, Ezekiel and Saxena, wrestled really with this idea of freedom and championed it against its many opponents. I have a lot of things to say, so I'll go fast on this. So freedom meant freedom from the reactionary revivalist forces so prevalent in India at the time for Ezekiel. It also meant, for both writers, freedom from the state and state control, from the centralization of all political, economic, and cultural powers within a few hands, which in Ezekiel's view also paves the way for censorship and for the temptation to suppress, that's his words, inconvenient voices from the margin. This, of course, explains why they could define themselves as liberal intellectuals, putting first, in the words of Ezekiel again, myriads of individual little truths that humiliate the truth with a capital T. Socialist realism, on the other hand, is defined in an article in Quest as flourishing in a culture where art and literature are transformed into the wheels and screws of the great state machine. It's a common kind of critic at the time. More significantly still, and I think much more significantly than anti-communism, their struggle, as I've suggested earlier, was also to free modernism and the notion of freedom itself, as it were, from ideology. Hence, Ezekiel's constant attack on closed systems of thought, on certainties that lacked the flavor of uncertainty. One of his columns in Fulcrum is actually titled Uncertain Certainties. How long do I have permission? Sorry.
5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. Just if we want to recall some obvious facts, that the Cold War can be understood both as a form of synchronization of literatures across the globe, which contributed to create a world literature, and conversely as a form of disjunction, as we all know, with world literatures partitioned along antithetical ideologies. The Cold War, as we all know, undeniably sharpened the debate between the politics of art and its autonomy, and Francesca has talked about that. The division between social realism the division between social realism versus what has come to be known as abstract expressionism was first articulated in Clément Greenberg's essay, Avant-Garde and Art, where he defines the avant-garde as art in which it is difficult to inject propaganda because it turns away from the masses and from subject matter. So the so-called individualism and autonomy of modern art becomes a bulwark against totalitarianism. So this debate, Francesca has talked about it, so I won't, took an indigenous form with the Prayogvad experimentalism versus progressivism dichotomy. But a lot of writers, I think, struggled to liberate themselves from these binarisms. And they also struggled to liberate themselves from a certain view of what modernism and the avant-garde were supposed to mean at the time. In his book, Cold War Modernists, Barnizel, Greg Barnizel, argues that by repurposing modernism, American cultural authorities turned the avant-garde into the establishment. They remade the once revolutionary movement into a content-free collection of artistic techniques suitable for middle-brow consumption. So modernism was not only constructed as opposed to social realism, but purged of its rebelliousness and radicalism. That was obvious concerning the privileged medium of modernism, that is a little magazine, whose legacy, and that's Elizabeth Holt saying that, noting that, whose legacy the CTF sought to inherit, but without its vulnerability and its anti-bourgeois ethos. So for some writers, the struggle, for some Indian writers, the struggle was also precisely to recover the oppositional and demotic dimension of modernism and of the avant-garde little magazines before its institutionalization by Cold War cultural politics. And we come back to the logic of refusal that J.S. Saxena's article advocated, and which signals in part the passage from the height of the Cold War in the 50s to the late 60s, which is also the internationalization of counterculture and the move from an officially endorsed culture to subcultures, which to a certain extent valorize cultural outlaws. In the Indian case, however, and I'll finish on that, this transition only partly intersects with the transition from one type of journal, say Nissim Ezekiel's Quest, to another, say Arvind Krishnamurti's mimeographed, handcrafted, and unestablished Damyu. When Mehrotra set out to oil and set the mimeo machine like a machine gun, that's a line from an issue of his little magazine, Damyu, from Allahabad, Ezekiel, of course, embodied a form of establishment and was one of the inevitable casualties of Mehrotra's blasts. Yet, as I've shown earlier, Ezekiel strove to nurture a critical, pluralist, non-conformist spirit in Quest, and he was extremely wary of state institutions, bureaucracies, and academies. And I say that their struggle for freedom and independence, their cultivation of alternative, creative, critical voices, their space-clearing gesture is much more similar than Mehrotra would have liked to acknowledge at the time, as was their staunch opposition to all forms of ideological, national, or literary recuperation. Through their respective journals and magazines that they tirelessly edited or contributed to, however minor, little, or marginal platforms they were, both also struggled to redeem the culture of shortages we talked about earlier. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Moon OCG podcast. In our next episode from the Postcolonial Print Cultures Conference, we'll be listening to Ravani Ranasinghe's talk, Tambamurthy and Shivanandan, Cold War America and International Socialism.